Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. I'm your host, Nicholas Rapold. Garrett Bradley is the director of Time, the Oscar-nominated documentary about Sybil Fox Richardson and her efforts to get her husband released from prison. Time is one of my favorite documentaries of the past decade, and Bradley has also directed several incredible short films, including Alone and America. She has just published a new book called Devotion, which will be celebrated this weekend with a program at Metrograph. She'll be appearing for screenings of her shorts, her documentary Time, and a separate film she chose, Devi, directed by Satyajit Ray. I was really happy to have a conversation with her about the instincts that guide her filmmaking, the importance of editing in her practice, her thoughts on her short film America, and what she's working on now. Let's go to the conversation. Hello, Garrett. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for that. It warms my heart.
This book, I love that it is, you know, a mix of interviews and articles, but also just opens with, I think, around 100 plus pages of stills. So just very grounded in images as well. So I just wonder if you could start by talking about your concept for the book. I mean, if I'm right, this is the sort of first, I don't know, feature length book that you've done, or?
Yeah. I mean, I've never made a book before. So, I mean, it really was like, you know, I liken it to running in a dark room, you know, like I really didn't have any context for what the process was going to be like or anything. So it was a real journey. And we worked on it for about a year. And Ossian Ward, who's the editor of the book, he, I think, really kind of spearheaded this collaboration between MIT Press and Listen Gallery. So this is actually just the first of what will be, I think, many books, sort of artist books in relationship to these two other institutions. And so, you know, the benefit with it being sort of the first book, there was a lot that had not been set in stone, you know? So there was, I think, a lot of freedom and ability to play, but also, I think for me, really wanting to take into account that if there was going to be a desire for consistency with this ongoing series, the choices that I was making, or, you know, and that we were making together, how they would also have an impact on future artists. And every artist is going to, you know, want to explore and articulate their work in this format in a way that feels natural and good to them. So there were these really interesting kind of dimensions to how we were really thinking, both in terms of the context of my own work, but also more globally around how do you create an object, you know, that allows for there to be a real freedom and autonomy then for anyone coming after.
I wonder if you could just talk about the title, Devotion, what that meant to you and how you settled on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Titles, names for things are just like so hard for me. I mean, even just with my own work, when it comes down to that moment of naming something, I find that to be one of the hardest parts of the process, actually, just because it's so definitive, you know. But devotion felt like a really, it reflected what it feels to make things for me. You know, I think, I mean, the actual definition of devotion, my friend Jules Febre, who's a yogi and knows a lot more than I do about things like this, you know, he was explaining to me that actually the real definition of devotion is, or the first sort of stage of being able to devote yourself to something is to first understand it, that you really have to understand something in its totality in order to really be devoted to it. And I think that that was a really kind of essential piece of knowledge for me, that devotion is as much about understanding as it is about something that's blind and unconditional, you know? And I think that the people that I work with, the process that I take very seriously in bringing something to fruition always starts with understanding it in its fullest totality and all of its dimensions, you know, the things that are difficult, the things that are complementary, the things that aren't. And then finding a sort of visual articulation for that. And so devotion felt like I was sort of trying to get at this idea of these are the things that I've come to understand, you know, up until this point in my life. And these are the people that have helped me to come to those understandings.
Yeah. And I mentioned that there are dialogues. I should probably use the word dialogues better for the conversations that are in the book. I mean, they're just really incredible. And I was thinking about how that does come back to, you know, what you've talked about, which is conversations and how you are preparing when you're making a film. And I wonder if you could talk about that process, you know, how you break the ice with someone or how you achieve the trust that is so important. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, yeah, sure, to build trust, I mean, time is a factor, but also I would urge anyone to also just sort of think about their own instincts and how they move through their day, right? Sometimes it actually is an instant that you need to know whether you trust a situation or a person, right? You don't need to know someone's name. You know, you might just be standing next to them online and be able to pick up on that. So I think that, you know, my answer always when that sort of comes up around how do you develop relationships with people and build a sense of trust with your collaborators, I think first and foremost, it's instinct. And the instinct is coming from a sort of ability to discern or smell intention. And so it really starts with, I think for me at least, being very clear about what is my intention in wanting to make something? What's my intention in wanting to engage with a person to create something? And then it's also for me needing to understand what's their intention and do those two things intersect with one another. And you'll know, I think, really quickly if they don't, you know. And sometimes it's more, it does require a longer sort of gestation period, you know. But I think that that's where it really begins. So it's not even sort of something that I think can be prescriptively outlined, you know, for a filmmaker to say, this is how you get someone to trust you, or this is how you develop trust. It's very much, I think, more about really being honest with oneself and being very transparent about what those things are that you feel and that you intend to do, even if those things are sort of ambiguous, and allowing another person to respond to that and bring their own intentionality and instinct to it. You know, it's really about merging instincts.
Well, I want to talk about some of the films that you'll be showing. I guess there's a Metrograph program, April 27th and 28th. For example, the short film Alone.
Yeah, so Alon Watts, who's the sort of central woman of that work, her name is spelled Alone and it has an accent on the E. It's pronounced Alon, but it's spelled Alone.
Because having just rewatched Time, I was sort of thinking about these movies almost in a bit of a dialogue and how they're, you know, connected for you. You know, one thing that I really felt was just how you're showing interiority and shots of kind of reflection. I mean, that's interesting because it's a conversation with the camera in a way, kind of catching what someone is doing. And I'm just kind of in awe about how in both of these films you're able to do that.
Thank you for saying that. I mean, it's funny because it's, what is it, 2024 right now? We're in 2024, right?
I think so. I don't know.
I think the time period in which that a lot of that work was made, which was like roughly, I want to say between like 2017 and 2020, that time period feels really far away for me right now in a certain kind of way. And I think that when I was making those films and I was working with my friends, you know, and people in my community to really try to offer multiple perspectives on a pervasive, chronic, systematic issue in our country, you know, it's really the premise of our country through deeply intimate human experiences that are rooted in love and resilience. And it goes back to, I think, what I was saying earlier, which is that it could have only been achieved through, I think, my own transparency and intention around why it felt like that needed to be in the world. And did they want to join in that journey and sharing their lives with the world, you know? So it's the film is a reflection of those two energies coming together. I think part of, and why I'm sort of stumbling with my words right now is that I think there's a real challenge I'm trying to kind of work through around the camera. You know, around how to actually, because we live in a world now where the oversaturation of images is so strong, you know, that to be somebody who works in images and works with images, it really kind of fucks with your head, you know? Like, how do I, because certain, you know, aesthetic, you know, all this stuff starts to sort of turn into something that actually doesn't feel like it has an emotional base to it, you know? And so what you're talking about is like, how do you retain emotional basis in an image saturated world is actually not something I think I have full control over. I think it is a completely almost kind of like spiritual, energetic force that is external for me and that operates between anyone who's willing to collaborate, you know? And it's a challenge, but I can't claim full control over how that ends up getting accomplished on some level, you know?
One thing I was thinking about watching the shorts, I was thinking about with the shorts, you were editing the shorts that you directed. And I wonder if you could talk about being in that space But it was interesting to me that on Time that you, I guess you worked with this with another editor.
Right. I mean, editing is so much fun. And it's actually, it's kind of like the one time, at least when you're working in a sort of quote unquote documentary context or journalistic context, you know, when you're working in a non-scripted space, I should say, editing is when you are the sort of closest in a certain kind of way to touching the work, you know, because everything else is quite like ephemeral. It's something that's in the air. But when you have the material and you are literally making choices around when you're coming in or when you're coming out and how you're creating transitions, and there's a sort of the tactility to the material is like a totally different level of intimacy that then goes away, of course, when the film is done and it becomes its own thing again. It exists like as memory again, you know? And editing for me is like, it's like playing an instrument, you know? And I think for me, a huge sort of turning point was, you know, I had been cutting Time on my own and kind of trying to figure out what the rules of the work were going to be. And I realized that I personally had hit sort of a bit of a glass ceiling. And that glass ceiling was that I realized what my own tendencies were, and that I have certain sort of like instincts, and that image making sometimes felt to me that it was enough to tell a story and to create sort of emotional connections. And I realized that there was a little bit of naiveness around that within the context of what was being created with Time in particular. And Gabe Rhodes, who was the film's editor, it was really interesting. Like, I'll never forget, he would cut a scene, right? And a lot of it, I would look at it and it would totally freak me out. I would be like, what is this? This is totally crazy. And he'd say, no, but listen to it. So don't watch it, but listen to it, you know? And it was really more about storytelling with dialogue and storytelling in a way that was not at first visual, right? And so then I would come in sometimes and edit things on top of this sort of, you know, dialogue-based, what was visually very kind of rough looking, and smooth it out with what I knew how to do with image making. So you bring those two things together, right? The images and the sort of the content and the dialogue. And he showed me a new way of storytelling, and like another format, another layer, another level of storytelling that I don't think I would have gotten to without his real brilliance in that. It was a turning point for me and a really exciting one. And one that isn't necessarily, when I say turning point, that I'm going to continue to go in one direction, but it was one direction that I think really worked, thankfully.
Yeah, I mean, the use of sound in that film, I mean, in that film, particularly you're talking about dialogue, the way it moves between dialogue and silences, and how that has an interplay with the feeling of stasis and momentum, and, you know, just that constant push-pull, which feels entirely part of, you know, Fox Rich's situation, that she's, you're waiting, and then maybe there's something, maybe there's not. So I really felt that, because she also finds such momentum when she is speaking, whether in public or in the kind of, they're almost like, maybe soliloquy is the wrong word, but, you know, when she's off the phone, you know, she has, think of the one where she's like, you know, they're going to pay, you know, and she moves through so many emotions in that.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think it's also, I mean, Alone, Time in America, we're all kind of made around very similar time periods. And, you know, America is a totally what I like to call like a modern silent film. I mean, there are pieces of dialogue that are interspersed throughout the soundscape, but there's no, you know, diegetic dialogue or sound, you know, we're not seeing sound in any kind of direct way. And so I think working through that, editing that, creating that with a totally different set of rules of how to create narrative and how to create story without words and without the same kind of tools that it would exist in, I guess, a documentary space, flipping between those two different sort of head spaces was a really amazing experience, you know? And I think, and that's also why I'm kind of excited to see, you know, I mean, Time came out during the pandemic. So really, for the most part, it was existing on TVs at home and probably iPhones and iPads. And so to be able to see this body of work that was really dear to me and really, really shaping of a certain kind of process and way of thinking about things all kind of together on a big screen, I think is going to be really special.
Yeah, no, and I wanted to ask about America as well. And that of course, uses shots from Lime Kiln Club Field Day. And I love the way the movie, I feel like it's partly reflecting on the relation of interiority to performance.
America was very much, you know, going back to, I guess, this idea of devotion and this idea of like of learning and understanding to the best of your ability in its fullest totality something in order to dedicate oneself to it. I mean, I spent a lot of time doing research around, you know, the turn of the century. And I was really looking to Burt Williams, who made this film, Limekiln Club Field Day, which the Museum of Modern Art had sort of rediscovered 100 years after its making, and are considering it one of the first films with an integrated production team and all Black cast. And Burt, you know, being very successful at that point in his career, is sort of at the center of this. And I found a lot of cinematic innovation and genius, and it was really quite ahead of its time in a lot of ways. Mm. And then also his role as a producer and a performer and a director in a lot of ways for that work, to me, was an indication of what else during this time period could have existed that was equally as progressive. And to really try to challenge this notion that Black cinema is sort of like a wave or a movement in time, that it's actually a consistent thread that's existed from the very beginning. And so America is a sort of historical chronology that starts in 1913 and is looking at certain moments in history. And sometimes they're explicitly historical and sometimes they're not, you know, like things falling from the sky, you know, or the Boy Scouts of America being established by Woodrow Wilson. You know, how do we insert ourselves into that conversation in a way that's also sort of inherently cinematic and also just lesser known? And so that was sort of the impetus for that. And in the process of making it, we were also working with students of mine, local blacksmiths, the Buffalo Soldiers, which are a historically Black pleasure aid and social club here in New Orleans. I mean, they're all over the country, but the New Orleans chapter. And so, you know, the cast in and of itself also sort of added this archival dimension to the project, because New Orleans in particular is, like, I think a lot of cities, changing rapidly, and especially so since Katrina. And, you know, you look at that film and there's, you know, blocks and areas that look totally different now. You know, I mean, that's kind of the beauty of making films, is they become archives. There's so much to say there.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Now popping into my mind is an image that kind of recurs in your films of like someone with the background is like flying by, whether they're on like a carousel or something, or, you know, so you're like a whizzing through your work. So I'm sorry for that. But I'm just...
Not at all. Yeah, it's true. I'm obsessed with like cars and things passing by, sirens. Yeah.
Yeah, just this movement. Well, let me ask maybe a couple more questions. One just about, because another part of the Metrograph program is, you know, you curated a film that's going to show with it, Devi, the Satyajit Ray movie. So could you talk a bit about that movie, which I've just always been so fascinated by that movie when I first saw it, like, oh, is this movie about whether we can capture spirituality on film? And then when I see it again, I think it's like, oh no, it's about the loss of control for a young woman. And each time I watch it, it turns into something else a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I'm convinced it's like the original Dune. Like, I'm pretty sure, like, this is just,
oh,
like,
wow.
You know, like, I just think that this, it has to be. And like, because so much of it is about the ambiguity of what's real. Hmm. And is she really the chosen one? You know, like, what's true? And what is the power of faith and our willingness to prove that and make it real?
Yeah.
And I think that, to me, it just felt like a really intriguing moment to sort of bring this film back, because it's beautiful. But it also, it goes back to, I think, even just, again, this definition of devotion, of like, if one must know in order to be devoted, and we live in a world now where knowledge and information has been so tainted, what does that say about our ability to be devoted to things? You know, what is it that we're devoted to if we don't have the information that we need? How do we create knowledge then? You know,
yeah.
How do we find it? So I think for me, that was, it felt like there were a lot of pockets and places for people to sit with that were not necessarily explicit, but that are definitely speaking to the moment that we're living in right now, which is so rooted in information and our access to information and our belief systems.
Yeah, that makes me think about, there's like a tainted form of devotion. People are devoted to things that involve having no knowledge, or, you know, it's about hating what you don't understand or who you don't understand or don't want to understand. And that somehow that is the form of devotion to a cause.
Right.
So I wanted to ask a couple questions. One is just, for this podcast, I always like to ask, what was the last thing that you saw, like at home or in the theater or whatever form?
Oh, man. I mean, the last film I really sat down and watched was the James Whale version of Showboat with Paul Robeson.
Oh, wow.
Which I want to say was made in the 30s, mid-30s. And I mean, Paul Robeson is just such an amazing, fascinating person. And, you know, whenever you watch him on the screen or hear his voice, I mean, it just, he doesn't feel like somebody who's from the past, you know? Mm. There's something very present about his presence. So that's the last thing I watched. To be honest
that's
with
great.
You, I haven't really, you know, I've been in this sort of pretty deep and just in research and feel a little bit like I've been in a cave for the past year, but it's good. I feel, I told myself, in addition to sort of focusing on my own work, I really want to find ways or alternatives to my phone and to screens, which I know all of us, we talk about this, and I'm not bringing it up so that anyone feels guilt, but I'd like to see people talk more about the solutions that they're finding for alternatives, right? And for me, that's been really about trying to pay attention more to what's outside in the physical world, what's going on with the things that I can actually touch. You know, I know all of us talk about this, you know, our relationship to screens and sort of the anxiety and the stress and even shame maybe that we might feel around not being able to remove ourselves around that, and the accessibility, you know, that that's not an accessible thing for everybody, right, to remove themselves. So how do we contend with this new era that we're finding ourselves in? And for me, that part of the solution has been, you know, really focusing on the 3D or the 4D. That's what I was saying, is I actually don't know. Do we live in 4D or 3D?
Is the fourth dimension time?
Oh, okay. Okay, well, let's just say things we can touch.
Yeah.
You know, like really, really putting an emphasis on the things that I can touch. And that's, you know, plants and objects and people and what's going on right outside my house, you know, on my block, what's happening there. And I think for me, that's been a really kind of amazing and healing space that feels like a nice sort of replacement for a lot of the anxiety that I think is felt, you know, with the rulership of devices.
Yeah.
I know I sound crazy, but
no,
that's where I'm at right now.
No, I mean, no, I totally hear you. I mean, that this is giving me flashbacks to the pandemic. We seem to carry it with us in a way. So yeah, I guess we can bring things to a conclusion there. But in terms of writing, I just have to ask, are you talking about the screenplay for Parable of the Sower?
That's one of them. Yeah, that is one of them. And I'm, yes, I, that is one of the things I'm talking about.
All right. Can you say anything at all about that, or what you're seeing or what you're visualizing? What's coming to your mind's eye with that?
No, I wish. I'm superstitious, you know, so I don't really talk about things until they're almost done. But
yeah. But
I, you know, I will say that I just am so honored to be able to work with the material at this point in time, you know, and I think that, you know, what the Butler estate is doing to sort of fulfill her destiny, you know, Octavia's destiny as a writer is incredible. And so I'm just honored to be a part of that and really, really excited about what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, thinking about her destiny, I always flash back to her notebooks, you know, which tell stories filled with facts, make people touch and taste and know, make people feel.
Yes, there you go.
I always love
that. That's it, man. Exactly.
Yeah. Garrett, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your work.
Thank you, man. I appreciate your time and your energy. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.